You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, from Kobe Bryant to Taylor Swift to the best game of basketball you never saw, author Chuck Klosterman joins us to help digest the best of American culture.
Now, since 2010, the political fight over the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, has been a constant, with Republican Congress members vowing to repeal and replace the law. And just a few weeks ago, the House of Representatives passed the American Health Care Act.
It's drawn criticism since one of its provisions would allow states to opt out of a particular part of Obamacare, protections for people with pre-existing conditions. But a new bill being proposed in the state legislature would require Wisconsin insurance companies to provide coverage for people with pre-existing conditions.
Representative Daniel Reamer joins us now. He's one of the co-authors of the proposed legislation. He's a Democrat representing the 7th Assembly District, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Reamer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Judith, for having me on your show.
So you are a co-author of legislation that, as we said, is requiring Wisconsin insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. Why is this a priority for you right now?
Well, it's currently a part of the law. Insurance companies throughout the United States have to cover people with pre-existing conditions that could range from diabetes, heart disease, cancer. But the concern that I and my colleagues have, and the reason that we've introduced and pushed these bills forward, is that currently the House of Representatives, having just passed legislation that would make major changes to this country's healthcare system, is pushing that forward to the Senate, and that could allow states like Wisconsin and other states throughout the country to opt out of requirements in the law that insurance companies cover people with a range of pre-existing conditions and not charge them higher premiums and not exclude them from coverage altogether. So we are not confident that the president will veto a bill that comes to his desk that gets rid of those protections for folks. So we wanted to make sure that they're a part of state law and that, at least in Wisconsin, we continue to protect people who, you know, most often through no fault of their own, you know, maybe they were born with a heart defect, maybe they were born with diabetes, maybe they developed an illness later in life, and that makes it harder for them to get insurance because they're excluded altogether or they're charged much, much higher premiums. About one in four adults between the ages of 18 and 65 in the state of Wisconsin have some kind of pre-existing condition. That doesn't always exclude them from coverage, but it can be one of the things that puts them at risk if they're trying to do the right thing and cover themselves and their family.
So the bills that you are proposing or circulating right now, would these keep exactly what was under Obamacare in place, or would are they different?
Yeah, it's different than the Affordable Care Act. In some respects, it doesn't have anything to do with Medicaid or subsidies for people who purchase insurance. It doesn't require anyone to buy insurance, which is one of the, which are some of the key features of the Affordable Care Act. This focuses on the provisions that are included in the Affordable Care Act that protect patients from some of the abuses that were common prior to the passage of the ACA in 2010. So in addition to protecting people with pre-existing conditions, the package of bills prevents insurance companies from imposing so-called annual or lifetime limits. So a lot of times people would get cancer or they'd get in a really horrible collision and face serious rehabilitative costs as a part of their injury. And those kind of procedures can be very expensive over the course of a year, over the course of a lifetime. You know, people already have this horrific, say a car accident happens to them and they become, you know, in some cases paralyzed from the waist down, and the treatment to get better can be very costly. And, you know, a good friend of mine was in a car accident. His family was killed. He was pretty much paralyzed from the chest down, and this happened in 2010 to him. So he was getting treatment. His insurance company sent him a letter that said, "You've hit your limit we can't pay for your treatment anymore. And just a few days later, he got another letter from the insurance company saying, because of the Affordable Care Act, we cannot impose these limits on you, and we're going to continue to cover your care. So that kind of thing, you know, it wasn't all that common, but for people who had really serious injuries or really serious and expensive treatment for an illness, it would sometimes hit the limit. The other thing that the bills do that we're proposing require it in state law that insurance companies cover what the law calls right now essential health benefits. So that's things like services to the emergency room, services if you end up hospitalized, services for maternity care for women who are pregnant or having a child, and other services for rehab and prescription drugs that people need. That also would cover preventive services at no cost. So a lot of screenings actually prevent longer-term costs for families and for the healthcare system as a whole. So we want to make sure people are getting screened for diabetes, high cholesterol. Some screens check people for cancer, and that prevents them not only from getting sick, but it prevents them from a big bill down the road.
Representative Daniel Reamer is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th Assembly District, which includes Milwaukee, and we're discussing the legislation that he is co-authoring that would require Wisconsin insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. Now, the fight over the Affordable Care Act, the Republicans wanting to repeal and replace it, their American Health Care Act that has come out of the House, that's certainly been a very partisan fight in Washington. You and Senator John Erpenbach are both Democrats and proposing these bills. How will you try to get your Republican colleagues here in the state on board?
Well, about a week ago on the floor of the Assembly, we introduced a resolution that would have opened up debate for the protection of people with pre-existing conditions and opened up the debate for a proposal like the ones that we've introduced to put those protections in law in the state of Wisconsin. The Republican Speaker of the State Assembly, Robin Voss, moved to adjourn and shut down the debate for the day, even though we had other bills on the agenda. So, you know, at first I was encouraged by the broad range of folks, you know, just ordinary voters who came forward with their stories about some one in their family or maybe themselves who had a pre-existing condition and had difficulty getting access to health care or had additional costs as a result of their pre-existing condition. It was my understanding that the debate about health care policy throughout the country and about the Affordable Care Act, which has been a divisive bill, there were a number of points of agreement. One of them was that we should protect people with pre-existing conditions. We should make sure people don't get arbitrarily cut off from care, and we should make sure that people get access to the basic services that prevent them from getting really, really sick in the future. And, you know, so far, almost all the Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate have signed on to these bills, have supported them publicly. Right now, we're going to continue to push our Republican colleagues in the legislature to sign on, but we haven't been able to get them to sign on or to support these bills publicly.
And as we wrap up, Representative Reamer, Governor Walker has switched gears a little bit in addressing pre-existing conditions. Previously, he has said that he thought Wisconsin should opt out of pre-existing condition coverage, but he's walked that back a little bit earlier this month. What are your thoughts on where he's at now, and what will you do to try to win him over?
Well, that's right. At first, Governor Walker said that the state of Wisconsin might opt out of these protections for folks who have cancer, heart disease, diabetes, other pre-existing conditions. Then he sort of changed the way that he talked about it, and he said, well, we'll cover people or we'll work to get people covered if they have pre-existing conditions through something called a high-risk pool. And now there's a problem with the way that he described it and with the way that he wants to do it, and that's this. To get to a high-risk pool, that would mean that Wisconsin is opting out of pre-existing condition protections. High-risk pools, which we had prior to 2010, were hard for people to get on. There was a six-month waiting period. Now, in most cases, if you wait 6 months to get health insurance It's not the difference between life or death. But if you're facing serious medical crisis, if you're in the midst of an illness that requires that you get care right away, or if you were part of a horrible collision that means that you need care right away, it can be the difference between life and death, and recovering and not recovering. So that's problem number one. The second problem with these high-risk pools that have been proposed by Governor Walker and Republicans, like the chair of the Joint Finance Committee, John Nygren, is that they're more costly to the people on the plan. The whole idea of insurance is that we bring everybody in together. The hope is that everyone stays healthy and that we, you know, pay premiums to prevent the risk of getting injured or sick. But if you have a pool of just people who are so-called high risk, just people who are very costly, it's no surprise that, that premiums are going to be very, very expensive for those people on those plans. So moving away from these protections and moving toward a high-risk pool prevents people from getting care and is far more costly for the people who will eventually get care after a long waiting period. And that's why it's a bad idea.
Well, Representative Reamer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be on the show. Thanks so much for having me.
Daniel Reamer is a Democrat representing the state's 7th Assembly District, which includes Milwaukee. He joined us today to talk about legislation he's co-sponsoring that would prevent Wisconsin insurance companies from capping benefits or denying care for people with pre-existing conditions.
Coming up, Chuck Klosterman is one of the most prominent journalists and authors to turn his eye on American pop culture. He joins us next. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark says he'll be leaving his job to work for the Department of Homeland Security. We'll find out how some are reacting to his potential departure.
First, Chuck Klosterman has been steeped in American pop culture for years. He started off by writing about sports, and then when the firewall between sports journalism and other areas burned down, he moved on to music.
Most of Klosterman's new book is about sports and music, but he makes time for TV, nostalgia, and Mountain Dew. Over the years, Klosterman has written for Spin, The Washington Post, and GQ. He's also the author of best-selling books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. His latest book is called Chuck Klosterman 10, a highly specific, defiantly incomplete history of the early 21st century. He's in Wisconsin for two book events. Chuck, thanks for stopping by the studio.
Thanks for having me. It's very flattering.
So your book is, there's a big X on the cover of this very stark black and white book, the numeral 10, Roman numeral 10. It's your 10th book, and you're revisiting all these old stories. You're hanging out with your old work, rekindling these sources, calling them on the phone. You're really thinking deeply about what you wrote in the aughts. Did that feel unnatural at all to form deeper connections with your earlier writing?
I wouldn't say it feels unnatural as much as it just feels bad. Because you go back and you read things you've done, you've written in the past, you know, and it is impossible. I don't know if this is how it is for all writers, but certainly this way for me, that if I go back and read something that I, you know, wrote 5 years ago, which I normally never do, I never reread my old books or anything like that, but when you're putting together an anthology, you have to do this. You spend the whole time thinking, well, the idea of this story isn't so terrible, but boy, I used punctuation poorly in this, and that joke is stupid. Why did I do that? And it's like, I could have cut this out, nobody would miss it, or why didn't I talk about this thing that was actually the most important thing? Every piece seems bad. And, you know, you have this weird sort of cognitive dissonance where you have to convince yourself, well, you know, you are republishing this work and expecting people to buy it, so it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to fixate on how you hate it, but that's just the way it is, you know? It's hard to be a normal person.
You were born in Breckenridge, Minnesota, sharing a border with Wahpeton,
yes,
North Dakota.
Yes.
I'm going to project here that you had a somewhat Fargo-ish upbringing. How might that have informed your path as a pop culture observer and writer out there on the prairie?
Well, first of all, I didn't have a Fargo-ish growing up. That was like...
Metropolitan.
Life.
Okay.
Well, it was. Because I grew up on a farm outside of a town called Wymere, North Dakota. Wymere had like 500 people. We were 65 miles south of Fargo. And Fargo was almost like an aspirational place. I mean, we didn't have cable growing up. Nobody in town had cable, certainly not on the farms. You know, we had very limited radio options. So the only culture I got was like the most populous, biggest culture there was. In fact, I've mentioned this before, but remember that song "Small Town" by John Cougar Mellencamp?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Well, I used to listen to that song, and I always assumed he was talking about places like Wymere. I had no idea he was talking about like Indianapolis and like, you know, Milwaukee and stuff. Like, that's what he considered to be a small town. When I found out that he was actually referring to places which to me seemed like a completely major market, I was shocked. Like, it's still weird to me to think that Fargo to the world is a small town, is almost a rural town. It will never seem that way to me.
You sit down with these incredibly high-profile people, from Kobe Bryant to Taylor Swift. At one point, you tell Kobe Bryant that there's no point pretending you're going to have a normal conversation because there's nothing normal about it. Does it still feel like a human transaction, the conversations you have, the interviews that you have with these celebrities?
I don't know if many other journalists do this or do these interviews the way I do. In fact, I'm pretty sure that they don't. But, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years now. And what I have found is that particularly when you're dealing with kind of these apex performers, you know, Kobe Bryant or Taylor Swift, you know, Bono from U2, or, you know, like, you know, Britney Spears, the really, really, really famous people who are, for lack of a better term now, famous for what they do, but also famous purely for their fame. This idea that somehow I'm going to sit down with them in a limited amount of time and convince them that we're having a normal conversation, that just seems like a completely fraudulent thing to me now. So what I do at this point in my career is I say, hey, look, you know, I know you're only here because this is something you do as a part of your life now, as somebody who has to deal with a mediated culture. And the only reason I'm going to be able to ask you the questions I'm going to ask you is because I have a tape recorder and I am taking notes. You know, there's nothing real about this. But the things I'm going to ask you are things I am authentically interested in. They are not things I'm asking because I think this is what a journalist is supposed to do. I want to know this stuff, and this is how it's going to be. I'm going to ask these questions, and you be as honest as you can, and I'll try to be as objective as I can. And I have found that that works better.
Let's stick with Kobe Bryant for a second here. And at the end of the interview, you're walking out to your rent-a-car, and you're thinking, that really worked. What made that one so special?
Well, here again, or I should say, this is like always odd to sort of concede this, but when you interview celebrities and you do these profiles, if they are great, most of that credit actually does go to the subject. I mean, Kobe Bryant made a decision, I don't know why, but he made a decision either the day that interview happened or a few days before, that I'm just going to be candid now. And I'm going to answer any question the guy asked me as honestly as I can. And I'm even going to bring up stuff that I know he wants to ask but might feel uncomfortable doing so. I mean, it was just, you know, sometimes with a musician or an actress or something, you know, they have a vested interest in being interesting in the interview. It could help their career. It doesn't really help athletes. What athletes do is an objective thing. There's no subjective quality. So usually when you talk to an athlete, they're not really willing to sort of expose themselves
to
show vulnerability.
Yeah.
But he just made the decision, I'm going to be this way now. And I've never really had an interview like that where, you know, he brought up the accusations of rape against him before I did. I was going to ask him, but he brought it up. And I think it's because I started the interview by saying, look, I'm just going to ask you these things. I'm not going to pretend like we're going to be friends after this. This is it.
Yeah. We're talking right now with Chuck Klosterman. His new book is 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century. And it's a revisit of your pieces that you've done so many for so many outlets. You equate yourself to Charlie Brown. You identify with Charlie Brown. I'm wondering what would Charlie Brown say right now to the West Wing, to the Trump administration?
Oh, good grief. I don't know. that sounds like a setup. Well, what would Charlie Brown say to Trump? Well, you know, the thing about Charlie Brown is he is an incredibly optimistic person. It doesn't matter how many times the football gets pulled away. He's like, maybe this time. So I suppose Charlie Brown would actually be like, you know, you can still be a mediocre president. You can still do this. I think he would try to support Trump, weirdly. But, you know, then Linus would be like, you're crazy.
You and the book talking about death, a topic you say you used to be obsessed with. But all that changes when you have kids, you see the passing of a parent. What is your view on death these days?
Well, the thing that's sort of, you know, the irony in this is I wrote a book called Killing Yourself to Live when I was 33, where I was just obsessed with the idea of death. Now, you know, my father has died. I've had friends die. Obviously, my body is breaking down. I have kids now. Death is actually much more involved in my existence, but I don't think about it now as a theoretical thing. And I feel like now I'm almost pushed away from the idea of the entertainment value or sort of the cultural significance or symbolic value of people dying. And I think that's happened because of the internet. I think the internet has changed the way we look at life.
And you had a pivotal moment when Prince died and you realized something about yourself and how you view pop culture.
I was walking into a movie theater in the middle of the afternoon, find out on my phone that Prince has died. Go in and watch the movie, spend 2 hours kind of thinking about Prince, you know. It seemed like it was a big deal to me, right? Because I loved Prince growing up for all these different reasons. But then I get out of the theater, check my phone, and seemingly on all these social media extensions, I guess I didn't care about Prince at all. People were just losing their mind and being so performative about the passing of the stranger they had never met. And in a way, really talking about themselves, finding ways to sort of attach the significance of their life with the significance of this great artist. And it just made me think, I got to think about other things.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Chuck Klosterman is a best-selling author and journalist. His new book is titled Chuck Klosterman 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century. He'll be appearing in Madison tonight at 7 o'clock at the Madison Public Library. Tomorrow, Friday, May 19th, he'll be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock as well.
This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tonight after 6, it's another installment of WPR Next with new program pilots produced here at WPR. Tonight, it's Wisconsin Life Weekend. Host Erica Janik highlights the people, places, and stories that make Wisconsin unique.
First, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark has built a following for provocative statements against Black Lives Matter and other liberal groups. He's a polarizing figure who has earned himself a following beyond Wisconsin, particularly from conservatives.
The sheriff might now be off to Washington, D.C., according to statements made in an interview with WISN AM yesterday.
I will be leaving the position of sheriff to accept an appointment as a Assistant Secretary in the Department of Homeland Security. I'm both honored and humbled to be appointed to this position by Secretary Kelly, working for the Trump administration.
But so far, the Department of Homeland Security has not announced or confirmed that appointment so far.
Clark already has ties to the Trump administration. Shortly after President Trump was elected and selecting new cabinet picks, Clark was seen at Trump Towers for a meeting.
If Clark does leave his current position next month, our next guest says his departure could be a good thing for Milwaukee. Ernie Franzen joins us now. He's the Associate Opinions Editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and you can find his writings about Sheriff Clark on the Central Time Facebook page. Ernie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's first take a look at the announcement. Clark said that he's planning on going to work for the Department of Homeland Security in the department's Office of Partnership and Engagement. Is it surprising to you that the Department of Homeland Security has not yet confirmed the appointment?
No, I don't think it's surprising. I think he may have jumped the gun on this. Apparently he jumped the gun on this. which is probably not unusual for the sheriff. But that they haven't confirmed it yet doesn't surprise me a whole lot. If they don't confirm it by June, I'd be surprised, but I think that's coming soon.
Well, and on the other side, Governor Walker's spokesman, when he was asked, said his office has not yet received a formal resignation letter from Clark. Do you read anything into that?
No, I mean, I think Clark will send that letter as soon as he gets, you know, the official word from Washington. My guess is, and I don't know, I don't have any special insight into this. My guess is he's been told he's got the job. They weren't quite ready to announce it yet, and he sort of blurted it out. But my guess is this will all happen, and he will be sending his letter in, and the sheriff, the governor will move on from there.
So you write that Clark's departure would ultimately be a good thing for Milwaukee. What reasons would you point to?
Well, I mean, the sheriff, his track record over the last couple of years has not been very good. Four people died in his jail last year. An inquest jury recommended charges against seven jail personnel involved in the death of Terrell Thomas. The sheriff was not a target of that inquest, but he also has been very close-mouthed about all of those deaths. So he's not forthcoming. He's not telling the public what they need to know. He spent a lot of time over the last year on the campaign trail for thumping for Trump, which obviously paid off for him. He has his tweets, not unlike the president's, tend to be way over the top and inappropriate. And there was the incident with the guy at the airport down in Dallas who rolled his eyes or shrugged at the sheriff as they were getting on a plane. And then that guy was detained when he got back to Milwaukee. So to some people, that's an abuse of power. We thought that was an abuse of power, and we wrote about that. So there are a whole slew of reasons. He just hasn't been doing his job. Now, I just posted a blog item that says we also don't think he's necessarily a good post for Homeland Security. So he's not a good fit for either job.
So you pointed to several of the recent things that have been gaining attention in Milwaukee, those episodes that happened, tragic episodes in the Milwaukee County Jail, over which Sheriff Clark holds responsibility. Going back earlier in his tenure, were there also things that you would point to that you say show that he's not a good match for being sheriff of Milwaukee County?
Yeah, I mean, he once said that residents should have guns in their house because calling the police or calling the sheriff's department will not get the response they need. I mean, that coming from a law enforcement officer, that struck us as inappropriate. Now, I've got to say this though too. I was here when Clark started. And I thought he was fine. I thought he got off to a good start. I remember the first meeting we had with him. He came in. He brought some books with him about law enforcement. He was an articulate, obviously intelligent guy who had all the intent of doing a good job as sheriff. And I don't know where that all sort of went off the tracks, but obviously it had a lot to do with the politics and certainly the politics of the last 5 years, say, but I thought he got off to a good start and he was doing some good work. And I'm sort of surprised. I was surprised when things went south on him.
So you said that it seemed like he started with, you know, good intentions coming into the job, wants to do a good job. But then you also say that he lost interest in being Milwaukee County Sheriff a while ago. So do you think he's always had these other ambitions for a while, or is there something about, say, seeing Donald Trump really rising on the national scene that kind of inspired him?
I'm not sure what it would be. Maybe it was Trump. Maybe it happened started before that. I think some of those things go back before that. But certainly, you know, speaking at the Republican convention and blasting the Black Lives Matter movement, That all came about as a result of the Trump campaign and his latching on to the Trump campaign. So when that happened, I don't know. I do think that he did, you know, he did try to be a professional law enforcement officer, and I don't think he ever totally gave that up. But clearly at some point, his interests switched, and he wanted, either through ambition, because of ambition or whatever, or because he was tired of the job, he wanted to move on. So, I mean, it's been 15 years since he was appointed as sheriff and then elected to his first term that same year.
We're talking to Ernie Franzen of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're looking at an editorial piece he wrote saying that if Sheriff David Clark leaves his current post and goes to the Department of Homeland Security, it would be a good thing for Milwaukee.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, what do you think of Sheriff Clark's announcement that he will be taking a job at the Department of Homeland Security next month? What do you think that means for Milwaukee or for the DHS? Are you concerned about investigations into multiple deaths and mistreatment at the county jail? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up the conversation with Ernie Franzen of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote a piece saying that if Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark leaves his job to work for the Department of Homeland Security, it will be a good thing for Milwaukee.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. How did you react to Sheriff Clark's announcement yesterday that he'll be going to work for the Trump administration? Are you concerned about ongoing issues at the county jail on his watch? What do you hope for next in Milwaukee if he does leave? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones, and Steve in Kenosha is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Well, I disagree with Sheriff Clark on a lot of issues, but I think it's important that we only give criticism where criticism is due. And you just brought up the issue of when Sheriff Clark put out that video where he was saying that citizens should consider taking a licensed gun safety course, and that calling the sheriffs and calling the police might not be enough and they might not be there in time. So you misquoted him completely. So I think it would be respectful if you pulled up the actual quote and didn't lie on the air.
Ernie, do you have a response to that?
Well, I'd have to pull it up. I don't think I lied on the air. I mean, the implication certainly was that citizens might be better off having a gun in their house than calling the police. And Clark, if I remember right, and maybe I'm not misremembering, but if I remember it right, Clark support, came back with that and sort of doubled down on it.
All right. We'll look into that, and we'll try to get that before the end of the hour. There was a post on the Central Time Facebook page. John from Edgerton says, Los Angeles County Sheriff went to prison for 3 years for not taking control of deputies for abuses in their jails. And John wonders if Clark could face serious consequences. Also, as we mentioned, there are serious allegations and investigations and recommendations of charges to be filed because of things that have happened in the jail. Ernie, do you think that's a possibility?
It's a possibility. I don't think it's a real likely possibility. My guess is that it the sheriff will not be charged. Lawsuits certainly are one thing, but I don't think there'll be any charges from Chisholm against the sheriff. Whether there'll be charges against jail staff is another issue. And by the way, I just looked up the story that your listener was talking about, the radio ad. Your listener wasn't wrong. But the radio ad said, I need you in the game is what the sheriff is saying. With officers laid off and furloughed, simply calling 911 and waiting is no longer your best option. You could beg for mercy from a violent criminal, hide under the bed, or you can fight back. And then he talks about taking a firearm safety course and handling a firearm so you can defend yourself until we get there.
All right.
That, to me, still has the implication that you can't rely on law enforcement. And that undercuts, and I don't think that's true. I think you can rely on law enforcement. I think he was simply wrong in his position, and it certainly implies that you're better off with a gun than you are calling 911.
And, Ernie, let's talk about if Clark does go to Washington. As we said, this has not been confirmed yet by the Department of Homeland Security, but if he does go to Washington in this new federal post, what are the chances that he'll be able to leave these controversies behind them? There are these lawsuits about things in jail. One that we haven't touched on is a woman who filed a lawsuit because she was shackled when she was giving birth while in custody at the jail. Mm-hmm. Do you think that basically leaving the job means leaving those controversies behind?
My guess is no. I think he'll still be a party to those, if I understand that right. Although maybe it'll be just the jail, but no, I think it'll still follow him around. It also depends a lot on how he handles himself in Washington. If he has tweets and press conferences and news releases like he did here, of course those things will follow him. If he keeps a lower profile and just focus on the job, maybe he can dodge some of this. I don't necessarily think the job is a good fit for him because he's a very polarizing figure, and this job, from what I've read, requires him to work across the divide between political parties with law enforcement officials across the country. I don't know how well he can do that job, but will the controversies follow him? Probably, but again, a lot of that, I think, will depend on how he handles himself out there.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234, and Cindy in Appleton is up. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I would just like to say we've just added another clown to the circus that is known as the Trump administration.
And why do you say
that? I'm glad he's... Really? I mean, look at the baggage the man's got. Why would Trump want to bring somebody into his administration that has that much baggage? I just don't get it. I mean, I'm glad he's leaving Wisconsin, Milwaukee County. I don't think he's been good for us, but now he's going to go have his effects on the whole country. We're already a laughingstock. We really need more.
All right. Thanks for that call, Cindy. And Ernie, I know you're not someone that covers the national news exclusively by any means, but, you know, do you... In your viewing from where you sit, do you think it's really a concern for the Trump administration whether someone brings what some might view as baggage, as David Clark might?
Sure it is. And there's, I mean, Gwen Moore, for example, wrote a press release wrote an op-ed in which she said she doesn't know of anyone who is more unqualified for the position. People who have had the job before him. There's a piece in the Washington Post that talks about it, and as well as, I'm not sure the other one was, but in any case, two people who have had this job before him said he is unfit for the position.
Meaning the job at the Department of Homeland Security.
The job at the Department of Homeland Security, exactly. The Trump administration will have to be... I'm not sure it cares, but there could be some bombs going off at the Homeland Security now because of Clark. Who knows?
Let's go back to the phones, and Bill in Madison is up. Hi,
okay.
Bill.
All right. Listen, this is terrible. Clark is a good, honest law enforcement officer. Major city, no scandals. Yes, people have died in his jail. People have died in jails all over the United States. The Milwaukee Police Department has a problem with becoming the murder capital of the world. Why don't you hold the chief of police in Milwaukee responsible or the mayor of Milwaukee responsible for that? Clark hasn't had any children killed in his jail. And besides that, the guy's got the kind of stamina that where he'll stand up and support his people. And that's what we need in law enforcement.
All right. Thanks for that call, Bill. I would say that a newborn baby did die in his prison. I know that's not the kind of child that Bill was referring to. But Ernie, certainly Sheriff Clark does have some supporters out there.
Oh, absolutely he does. And I've heard from several of them, I mean, emails today, and we'll be running letters from them saying that he's done a great job. And there are, and you know, you can certainly argue that he's been a good, tough guy, tough on crime kind of guy on law enforcement. Part of the problem, though, is that the sheriff's office does not patrol Milwaukee streets. Yet it does it has certain responsibilities, but it has nowhere near the crime responsibility that the Milwaukee Police Department does. Can the MPD do more? Absolutely. Can the mayor do more? Absolutely. And we need to hold them account for what's going on in Milwaukee's neighborhoods. But to claim that for or against the sheriff when his department really isn't responsible for that, I'm not sure is valid.
Let's go back to the phones, and Terry in Milwaukee is up next. Hello, Terry.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. So my question is, you said that the sheriff is polarizing. Is that because he's an African-American that can think on his own and is no longer on the white liberal plantation?
Ernie, would you like to respond to that?
I think it's because the language he uses and when he threatens to beat up someone who was critical of him, when he calls the medical examiner's office and rails at him for giving out information, that's why he's polarizing. It's what he says and how he says it that makes him more polarizing than other political figures who may agree with him.
Thanks for that call. And Ernie, in the few minutes that we have left, let's look forward. If David Clark does end up leaving his position as sheriff of Milwaukee County, what does Milwaukee need in the next person who would hold that position?
You know, I think from our perspective, we obviously you need a professional, a law enforcement professional who can bring some order to the department, who can take care of whatever problems there might be at the jail, who will also deal with other officials on an open and fair basis, and it will deal with the public on the same level. You know, it's not enough to sort of hide behind the bunker and throw grenades over the wall. What you need to do is talk to people, be open with them, release information, and do those things as well as providing the professional law enforcement that the county needs in the areas of jurisdiction that the sheriff's office handles.
And now there are, I believe, the current term of Sheriff Clark would end in 2018. So Governor Walker will be naming a replacement for that interim period. Are there any predictions on who might rise in that pool?
Well, I know the his name is, I just had it here a second ago.
Is it Ernell Lucas?
That's it. Fix it. Thank you very much. Ernell Lucas is a former Milwaukee police captain. Now he's the vice president of security with Major League Baseball. Said he will submit his name to Walker. He had already said he was going to run against the sheriff, against Clark, in 2018. So that's certainly one name that's out there. I'm not sure about any others.
Well, we'll definitely keep an
John
eye on
Seifert that. Had said, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, we're running short on time, but we'll certainly keep an eye on that, and we will check back in with you in the future. I'm sure, Ernie Franzen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your time.
Ernie Franzen is Associate Opinions Editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about why he thinks that Sheriff David Clark's departure could be a good thing for Milwaukee. And again, you can read that opinion piece. It is posted over on the Central Time Facebook page.